All right, so welcome. How's the volume? Anybody have trouble hearing? It's good? Okay. Well, I'm taking this whole month of September, and I like to take it as an exploration of investigation. And that's been a very important part of my own practice, how investigation brings a foothold into daily life. So it's not just being on retreat or being in formal meditation. Investigation helps to really see the friction in life as a spiritual path in itself. And so I'd like to explore that with you these 5 weeks. So we do a format of doing a talk this week and then 2 weeks from now and then the last week in September, and every other week do a discussion. And during those discussions we'll provide a summary and an elaboration of the talk and do some exercises to help get a sense of what investigation is, at least from my standpoint. So a disclaimer is this is really from my own understanding of it, of how investigation works in my own mind, my own body, my own practice. So hopefully it's of use and it'll be helpful. Now, investigation is something that we can certainly use on in a meditation retreat when we have a very refined steadiness of attention, that we can really look very deeply at the phenomenon of our minds, of our bodies, of our heart. But investigation also provides this great link into our daily lives. Because any insights that arise in retreat, I feel, have to eventually be integrated into our daily life. We have to see, how do they work in the midst of an argument with my wife, or a difficulty with my daughter, or my boss, or with traffic? Because if I have this insight of deep peace and ease, and that falls apart the first moment I have an argument, then it hasn't been integrated as much. So investigation helps us to start to integrate these insights into our life. So you find that daily life can be as insightful as being on a retreat, if it's used in the right way. And investigation is a tremendous tool for this. The basic premise is that freedom, the sense of awakening, is not outside of this moment. It's not after doing all these things or these exercises or these retreats. It has to be available in this moment. And certainly sometimes we have to do a lot of cultivation, a lot of work to be able to have that arise, but it's reorienting toward this present moment. How am I meeting this moment? So during these 5 weeks together, I like to use as a progressive talk. So each talk will build upon the previous one. So there's a sense of laying the groundwork tonight, you know, the basic what is investigation, what it is not, how you can use it to help deepen your practice, kind of the basic process of investigation. And then the other 2 weeks, start to focus more in depth of which areas are helpful to look at. Which areas can we bring that attention to bring the unconscious more into our awareness? So tonight will be an overview of investigation, and also talking about the supportive factors of investigation, what really makes it start to click and work in our practice. So let's start with, what is investigation? You know, what is this thing that we hear so much about? The American Heritage Dictionary defines investigation as to observe or inquire into detail, examine systematically, to observe or inquire into in detail or examine systematically. This is a sense of looking underneath the hood, underneath the assumptions of how we take life to be, how we show up in the world, how we think we should be in the world. The root of that word, it's interesting, it has in, like going into something, but also has to track, like you're tracking a footprint. So there's a sense of, perhaps it's, often think of it as like a bloodhound who the scent is very faint. And the bloodhound attunes its senses to find that scent up and down through creeks and through valleys and trails, and able to find where that scent leads. And so too with investigation, when we have an area that's of interest, we start to follow it like that bloodhound, to have that sense of following that scent and attuning our mind, our body, our attention to be able to find that. Now, if you look at the Pali definitions for investigation, I found it showed up in two different lists, maybe more, but those are the two that I saw. The first one is the seven factors of awakening. The other one is the four bases of power. And it's interesting, the English word investigation is actually used to define two different types of Pali word. So the seven factors, it's Dhamma Vikara, or investigation into phenomenon. It's really seeing the arising and passing away of experience, of body sensations, of breath, of mind. They'll really tune into this phenomenon level of life. Well, on the four bases of power is defined a little differently. It's the Pali word is Vimassana, or Panna, or wisdom. And Tanissaro Bhikkhu defined this as mind's ability to discern, its ability to be ingenious. In other words, all the qualities of an active intelligence. So in this quality, from these four bases of power, there's this direction, like the bloodhound. This is the scent, and this is not the scent. This is the direction to go and to pay attention to, and this is not the direction. So investigation can actually make your practice kind of interesting, can make it kind of fun and light. Instead of just connecting with the bare experience again and again, you start to notice where you contract, where you get yourself into knots, where you show your suffering, and that becomes this very interesting thing to investigate. It becomes interesting because once you investigate it fully in one area, in one instance, and you see that through that investigation, you experience less suffering, it starts to reinforce it. You realize this is the direction to ease my suffering. Now, looking at those two definitions from the dictionary and then from the Pali, we have to be careful that we don't slip into what we sometimes call the near enemies and far enemies of investigation. So often this hasn't been used so much in investigation, but like in the Brahma Viharas, so a near enemy is something that's very close to the state, that's easy to confuse it, but it's not quite. The far enemy is something that's very different from it, very hard to confuse it. Because it's easy to slip into analysis, into rumination, to judgment. If we start to use our minds more actively in our meditation and in our spiritual practice. So often when we start off, we teach students to really connect with their bare experience, because there's so much momentum in our lives to be lost in thought, to be distracted. So you have to learn how to have that steadiness. And so that's the danger of investigation, is that we can start to get caught in the ideas around it. Because certainly our lives, we have a huge tendency to overemphasize the cognitive, to overemphasize the thinking mind. Basically, we tend to think too much. We overthink things. Because our minds really like to think and to conceptualize, to make ideas. Have you ever noticed when you meditate how much time you spend thinking? It's often a surprise when we start to meditate, we learn to meditate, we realize how much of my life is spent in thought, in idea. We talk about a thought stream, a stream of thoughts. It often is like that. When we have a thought, we step into that stream unconsciously, we're quickly swept away down to some unknown destination. So we might be trying to investigate, okay, let me feel the sense of restriction in my body. And then pretty soon, well, that kind of reminds me of that tension with my boss. And then, oh, that reminds me of my tension with my father. And so pretty soon, we're down this whole stream of thought without realizing that we've departed. So investigation is actually, in some ways, a more advanced skill, because we have to have these basic qualities that we'll talk about tonight. And so the mind does seem to like to think, likes to seem to analyze and to ruminate. But as I reflected on that, I realized that liking may not be actually the right word. I think as you start to connect to more areas of stillness and moments of stillness, and those start to deepen, you realize the mind actually does like to have more quiet. There's a sense of peace that happens. And the sense of wanting to think, the sense of endless thought, is actually this process of hunger, this process of just refueling, kind of this feeding frenzy to try to fill this unsatiable hunger through thought, and it never quite fulfills it. And so we have to keep thinking to try to do it. So we're kind of caught in this endless cycle. But as our practice deepens, we start to have more and more moments of letting go of that hunger in a very fundamental way. And our minds start to naturally become more quiet, become more at peace. So certainly thought has, investigation has this tendency to go into thought and elaboration of thought. So a very helpful component is to think of what's called the felt sense when we're using investigation. This helps to safeguard us from becoming lost in thought, from being caught in the endless cycle of ideas. So we can borrow this from psychology and a technique called focusing. So psychologist, Eugene Gildon, in about 1953, he did 15 years of research looking at his patients and saying, well, why do some patients do well in therapy and why do some don't do so well? And he realized the conclusion after looking at them, it wasn't the therapist's technique, it wasn't the approach, it was rather the way the patient behaved and what the patient does inside of themselves during the therapy session. Specifically, they found that without exception, the successful patient intuitively focused inside them himself or herself a very subtle and vague internal bodily awareness, or the felt sense, which contains information that, if attended to or focused on, holds the key to the resolution of the problems the patient is experiencing. Okay, so not just the ideas, but how does it actually feel in the body and the subtle parts of it? So sometimes when I teach this, people say, I look inside and I don't feel anything. Everything feels blank, or there's not a lot of emotionality going on. So we have to become more attuned to the subtle qualities of that, the subtle contraction, the subtle sense of pressure. It's often a sense of pressure or a sense of tingling. So you become more and more sensitive to those qualities. So it's like the very precursors to a full-blown emotion. If you look inside and expect to find full-on rage or grief or sadness, joy or fear, that may not be present in that moment. But there's these subtle flavors of it. So being like that bloodhound defense, see those subtle qualities that help us orient our practice. So this becomes a key difference that makes investigation as part of the spiritual practice versus conceptualization versus the ideas of practice. So we feel the impact in our bodies, in ourselves. So there's a sense of being very receptive, really feeling what is happening in this moment. Now, thought, I've emphasized just this difference between thought and investigation because we have to really have that sense of separation initially. But investigation does have this quality of making meaning of what we're connecting with. It might be the sense of deep archaic wounding, a sense of orientation toward life based on some trauma. Or it might, if you look at more from a Buddhist standpoint, the sense of what does it really feel like to cling, to really lean toward experience, to be pushing away from experience. What is the felt sense of that? So as you practice, you know, as you read a text or a sutta or hear a teacher, try to feel it in the body as you're listening, it's a really active way of being present. So it's not this passive way, it's actually not through the head, but through the whole body. And if you do that, you'd be amazed at the kind of connections that start to arise. You see things which seem very disconnected, oh, these are actually very connected. And in that seeing, they start to fall away. When they're unconnected because we're unconscious to them, they have a lot of power to drive us, to create our suffering. So we can look at investigation as a sense of learning to track this felt sense in the body, this felt sense of where is there the contraction. Looking at these footprints, these subtle footprints. But what are really the footprints that we're tracking? Now, from the difference between therapeutic, you know, a psychological approach and the Buddhist spiritual approach is that ultimately the tracks are seen in the context of the Buddhist teaching. The Buddha said once that I only teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And so you start to orient that this sense of investigation is always looking toward how am I creating suffering in this moment? What is unnecessary suffering? What am I adding to my physical pain, my emotional pain? What's the extra suffering that I'm adding? And what's the reliefs? What's the release of that suffering? The letting go of that suffering? You know, both aspects are really needed, because if we just focus on and what's wrong and what's contracted and how we lock up and contract and hurt ourselves and never see the release of that, our practice becomes very heavy, becomes very hard and depressed perhaps, overwhelming perhaps. But if we can start to see by looking and seeing where we contract, we also at the same time seeing how we release that contraction. And then our practice starts to become much more buoyant. We start to turn toward life with a sense of enthusiasm. Okay, here's this criticism, this feedback I don't want to hear. Instead of defending more and becoming more protected, there's a sense of, yeah, let me hear it. Let me actually become interested in how I react to it, how I get caught in this. And as you do this more and more, it starts to reinforce the looking, because you realize through the looking, through the turning toward life, that's the path to releasing, the path to finding freedom. I'd say that there's three qualities that we need for investigation to really work. Again, this is my take on it, so I may think of other ones later on, but this is what came to me in this preparing for this talk. So the first one is a steadiness of attention. A sense of our attention is steady, it's able to be focused. So I was meditating with you this evening and just noticing my mind, and okay, where is the investigation seem to be at the right time? So at first I was tired, I was a little sleepy, distracted, fatigued, and I could tell like my mind wasn't very steady. It's like if I went out on a slippery slope, or like if I went ice skating with my daughter. Okay, so I don't ice skate, so I'd be like holding the rails and being very unsteady on my feet. Like every step I might risk falling on my back. So that's how the meditation felt, that my attention wasn't really landing, wasn't really engaging. It was kind of slipping off my experience. But then as the practice went on, I was starting to feel like, okay, I can actually make contact with this breath, with this body sensation. So this is the steadiness of attention that has to come. And so investigation, that's one of the reasons it's a more advanced practice, is because you have to be able to see how is my mind right now. And we can't just kind of go into it blindly following the technique without discerning, is that the right approach right now with my mind? The weather system of my mind or the culture of my mind, is it really connecting with experience? Or is it kind of flitting across it? So there's a quality of really landing with that's needed. So years ago, I don't know if Rodney still does this, but I always appreciated his flashlight talk. When he would explain some of that, there's some nods out there. So he would take, to explain this quality of steadiness of attention, he would take a flashlight and shine it around the room and say, usually we start off, our attention is going from here to there, and then it's really out of our control. It's really driven by our wants and our desires, our fears, and just going all over the place. And through meditation, we start to learn to focus on one thing. Focus, I get distracted, I focus. Eventually, I start to build this muscle of mindfulness, really this ability to stay steady on one thing. So that's a prerequisite to have that steadiness. So sometimes our attention is like that, very steady on one object or one thing. And sometimes it's more like the light in this room. We turn the light on so we can see everything at once. So attention has this quality, or mindfulness has this quality of being very steady or one-pointed or being very broad. But if it's distracted, investigation is going to very easily turn into rumination, into thinking, being lost in thought. So when our attention becomes more steady, it's like shining a spotlight on the ocean surface. So if it's not very strong, it just sees the surface waves. But if it's deep, if it's strong and penetrating, it goes down through the surface, down to the deeper depths. And so it's an analogy for investigation with ourselves. We're often on the surface assumptions, surface experience. But if our attention is steady enough, it starts to go through those different layers of the unconscious, of the unknown, of the assumed assumptions. And so the steadiness is really essential so we don't become swept away by thought. So it's interesting to reflect on what are the conditions that allow mindfulness to be steady like that. Sometimes it's a momentum of practice. So we could take all of you in this room and do a day-long meditation or a week-long or 3 months, and our attention will become more and more steady, will become more focused because we'll just be doing this over and over again. So there's this momentum that builds up through practice. And just if you practice every day, you know, for sitting on a regular basis for 30 to 40, 50 minutes, that helps to keep your attention more and more steady. So it builds its own momentum. So that's an important aspect of it. Also, there's an interesting phenomenon that as our insights become more integrated into our lives, there's a natural quieting, a natural settling that happens. So we're able to be, our baseline of steadiness starts to move, become more and more steady. Right? First, we have to work really hard. I remember when I first started to practice, I was doing a lot of noting, and I would, it just felt like I was just noting every second. Just try to, you know, get lost in thought, come back. Get lost in thought, come back. But over the years, that's become much more steady. But another interesting thing is that the steadiness of attention is also naturally arises when our interest is there. When our sense of urgency, our sense of curiosity is there, we naturally pay attention. Now, Rodney has a story of a person who was on hospice and was able to, the wife was taking care of them and they were able to go for a walk after surgery. And each step was very tentative and very careful. And then she finally knew what it meant to do walking meditation. Just that preciousness of just this step, right? And this is really the gateway into daily life practice. Because we don't usually have the conditions that we can spend many hours a day meditating. We have to rely on finding this sense of interest, this sense of curiosity, and sometimes a sense of urgency to really see, to really show up for our lives, to be really curious. And that's really that one of the main arts of investigation, is that you find what lights up your curiosity, what draws your interest into your life. And sometimes at the end of a talk, there's not many questions, and sometimes it's because we're shy. But sometimes we just don't have that burning sense of, I want to know, I want to show up for my life, I want to ask these questions. This sense of wholesome hunger, this wholesome showing up for life. If you look at the four bases of power, there's desire, this desire for freedom, desire for lessening our suffering. There's energy and effort, this sense of incredible energy. And there's a sense of interest and intentionality. And also investigation. So these four really come up to balance investigation, allow us to see that in our daily lives. So as we go through these weeks, I'll propose different questions, different points of inquiry. But you're always welcome to see, well, what really makes me interested? And am I really interested in where is there suffering in this moment? Or maybe I'm more interested in where is there love? This is the first condition that's really important, the sense of steadiness of attention, which can be cultivated through practice, but also, most importantly, through our interest in our present moment, how we're suffering in our life. And the second one is also essential, and this is knowing the difference between thought and direct experience. So often we start off to practicing, there's no difference between what we think about life and what we actually experience it. It's like they become very melded. Right? And so that's one of the things we learn as a meditation student, is to start to separate out our ideas, our concept of life, and the actual experience of it. Now, it becomes, starts by just not believing in thought as strongly, realizing it. This is just a thought. There's a sense of spaciousness that arises with it. Right? But then we start to see even more closely, every time I look at something, a thought pops up. There's a bridge that was built in France. It was one of the largest bridges in the world at the time. And the French described it as being massive and powerful and strong. It was just the idea of when they saw the bridge, that's what popped up in their consciousness. The Germans, on the other hand, when they looked at this bridge, they saw beauty and grace and elegance. Okay, the French saw massiveness and power and strength. So what's the difference? The same bridge. If you look at the language of the feminine and masculine gender, bridge is masculine in French and feminine in German. So there's this really overlay of how we actually interpret life through our conditioning, through our ideas. And it's so close, it's so interesting to start to peel that away. Because when you peel it away, you don't lose the functionality of being able to call that a bridge, but you gain instead of this freedom of not being so caught in your ideas. Now you take that same thing of this bridge, it seems pretty benign. Now put upon that discrimination against people who are different than you. You know, different cultures, different race, different orientation, and how that grows into prejudice and racism and bigotry. And then getting more personal, how about for yourself, the sense of how you take yourself to be? Am I a good person that's fully deserving of being here, that fully accepts, you know, this deep exception, or is there these places that we judge about ourselves, that we close away and hold off the self-judgment? It's the same process of thought that's being believed in. So this is this quality of knowing the difference between thought and direct experience, we have to get some inroads into it, but it's a process that we work with for many, many years. So just to get a sense of that, hold up one of your hands for a moment. Just look at your hand. Just notice the initial ideas and thoughts and concepts that come up around it. And notice the concept of gender. This is a female hand. This is a male hand. And then see if you can peel away that concept. See your hand outside of the gender identification. Looking at the tone of the skin, you know, is it what race you would say, is it a brown or tan hand, black hand, white hand? And notice how there's a sense of thought that come up around that, and then peel that away. In the sense of what all the things you do with this hand, the typing or writing or work, whatever you might do with it, and letting that fall away. And just closing your eyes and going right into the actual sense of the hand, letting the outline of the hand fade. So you just directly touch the actual experience of the hand in this moment. You can see investigation has this quality of looking deeper, looking beyond the initial assumptions to the actual experience of our moment, of our bodies, of our hearts. So this grounds us in the present moment. That's one of the main things that's very helpful. It also starts to loosen this sticky quality of thought and concept. And we get so sticky we don't even realize we've put it upon it. This also starts to orient us toward the actual sense data instead of the concepts around it. We're not pushing away the thoughts, we're not ignoring them, but seeing them more in a wider context. It's like seeing, okay, there's the thought of my hand, there's the thought of my body, the thought of this experience. but I shift more emphasis on the body sense. This felt sense in the body, the subtle qualities of contraction and pressure. So we get more information. I like to tell students that when you do an investigation, think of it as a 5-to-1 ratio. So 5 parts body sensation and 1 part thought. So you're really connecting with that, the actual experience. Because when you practice this, the sense of being connected to the body really helps to ground out all of the subtle things that are being seen. So remember, investigation is seeing very closely all the different aspects. So imagine that we're in the top of this building, this 3-story building, the very top where the roof is. So let's say that's a concept we have about ourselves. Okay, and say I'm a failure at my work. Let's say it's something like that. So when you feel that sense, okay, I'm a failure, there's a tendency to go into more thoughts around it, or what I have to do to fix it, how I have to do something to alter it, or how, you know, that's really true, I'm really such a schmuck, whatever it might be. Instead, just feel that sense of, okay, I'm a failure, and tune into the body. So that's like being in the top roof line and looking all the way around, and feeling, how does it feel in my chest, in my belly, in my hands? What's the emotionality that comes up? What's the subtle beliefs around it? As you see more and more completely on that floor level, you find suddenly that you drop down to the next floor, to the 3rd floor, and there's a deeper belief that's there. And you spend time assimilating and connecting with all those body sensations, all those deeper beliefs, that emotionality. Again, that 5 parts body sensation, 1 part thought. And you start to see this different aspect, how this superficial thing is connected to something even deeper. Okay, so maybe not being loved. And you go down even deeper, and you see these deeper, deeper levels as you go through and take time to really connect with the felt sense in that moment. So you're not rushing the process. The process might take, I mean, sometimes this last year, some of the deeper ones took a few months, really, to go through. So there's just a lot of patience that's involved, this willingness to keep turning toward it. Okay, this is hellish, this feels terrible. But if there's a little bit of mindfulness, a little bit of spaciousness, then it's workable, right? When there's not the spaciousness, and not the sense of mindfulness, and you're caught in the pattern, and you're judging yourself, you're seeing the judgment, but you're thinking through the judgment, that's really hard. So connecting with the body kind of helps to broaden things out. So this is the second aspect, knowing the difference between thought and direct experience. So the final quality, in some ways, is the most important. This is the quality of unbinding or untangling. The sense of whatever we see it in the context of loosening, not tightening ourselves, not self-identification, not becoming more established in ourselves, but actually loosening up that sense of identity. Because we can use the same process we've described and actually still have the sense that everything I see, I form a conclusion around it, an idea around it, an idea about what it means about me and about other. Right? So I become more and more hardened in my positionality. So this quality of unbinding, of untangling, sees what's being seen in the context of loosening that binding, loosening that quality of contraction. So this is, I think it is the most critical aspect to make investigation work. It's this basic orientation of why we're practicing. And sometimes we practice to have less stress, to have less suffering, you know, more of a day-to-day level, or just to have more peace in my life. And with the idea is that I'm creating this peaceful sense of me. But investigation is really, it's the sincere practice that we even want to turn to that sense of having a peaceful sense of me, and that realizing that isn't enough. Because that peaceful sense of me is usually pretty dependent upon conditions. I can be peaceful as long as my wife does what I say, and my daughter does. My wife's here, so I'm teasing her a little bit. You know, as long as things are going the right way, then I can be peaceful. Okay? When the stock market drops and I see my retirement falling and I see my health deteriorates, where is there peace in that moment? So is there a peace that's so unbased in conditions, it's so strong, that's the peace that I'm interested in finding and orienting my practice toward. So this quality of unbinding becomes very subtle because it's like we always are trying to reform ourselves. We might have a sense of deep release, and then pretty soon we kind of form ourselves in relationship to that. Well, I really had a nice moment of non-self there. Let me tell you all about it. You know? So it becomes a key area of investigation eventually in our practice. How am I forming this moment? How am I creating myself in this moment? And what is my relationship to this experience? How I am forming in the sense of the relationship. So the path becomes seeking where is there is identification, where is the release of that identification. So as we practice, we need to have a taste of this for it to work. So taste can be very, you know, very small, very slight, but it can still be incredibly meaningful for us. And that's one of the delights of teaching a beginning class, is that people have these tastes. This like, oh, you know, after doing the class, I used to always yell at people in the car, and now I don't. Isn't that something has fallen away? At the end of a meditation, and even very new students see that there's something feels a little different. You often see it in their faces and their bodies. There's a sense of softness, a sense of receptivity. And they go to talk and they have to kind of bring themselves back into themselves. But there's that taste that they may not even realize that they're touching. They may not realize it's a process of something much bigger. And it may be a simple spaciousness around this breath, around this body sensation, around this emotion. In a sense of this moment is okay as it is. There's nothing needs to be done in this moment. Even a little taste of that is all we need. This is like glimpsing the ox. If you were here during the ox herding picture series, so the 10 ox herding pictures is a depiction of the spiritual path from the Zen tradition. It starts with this glimpsing of the ox, the sense of, okay, there's something outside of my normal way of being. This can also be framed as something is bigger than you. It could be connecting with nature, just seeing a beautiful sunset and really being so moved by that, being moved by a young child or an infant. There's a natural quality of stillness. It can also come with loss, with grief, when something that we thought would always be here, as Mary Oliver says, that we counted and carefully saved, watch it dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. When those moments happen to us, before the fear comes in, the grief, there's a natural quiet, a natural stillness. So this becomes this orienting factor, becomes the seed that our heart wants to keep returning toward, this quality of unbinding. And so often we have to really nurture that seed through the sense of faith that, okay, this experience is something that is that there's a potentiality in my life. There's a potentiality to grow into that. And that becomes the fuel that investigation runs off of, becomes the interest, becomes the desire to become free, to lessen our suffering. So it becomes this key orienting process to our spiritual practice. So instead of sitting with a sense of trying to become a more peaceful person or to lower my blood pressure and still keeping myself intact, there's this quality of remembering that unbinding, that release. And that comes into this, like a North Star that orients our map, orients our direction in our practice, really into our life. William Stafford, in his poem, The Way It Is, spoke nicely to this. The way it is. There's a thread that you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. So this quality of the thread is this sense of unbinding, a sense of loosening. So maybe just a subtle taste for many of us. Sometimes it's like the roar of silence in the room. Sometimes it's so strong you can't help but notice it. Sometimes it's this forgotten memory. We call it forth in our investigation. Investigation is to try to discover that thread through all aspects of our life. Now, William Stafford wrote this poem a month before he died. And that always is really poignant to me, to the sense of what is this, where was that thread for him in that last month of his life? So investigation is this art of finding the question, this point of inquiry that really makes us interested, that we really want to know, that our life almost feels like depends on knowing it. So a question that I offered for this homework is, where is your resistance in this moment? So, you know, first that may not feel like a lot of juice for you, but play with it as a way to work with it. Where is your resistance in this moment? Because that can take you in very, very subtle ways. Because so often resistance arises, and we quickly want to act from it. Fix it, get rid of it, move it. Okay, so resistance arises, can I actually meet it? So you hold the question. You hold it, you ask the question, and you just receive what comes toward you. You don't keep, okay, I can write. Sometimes we can write things down as another form of investigation. But this style is this moment by moment, how is it arising? Where is the resistance in this moment? Feeling the contraction in the body, tightening of the heart. There's the release of resistance. I've heard that if you go into the woods, you know, as you walk into the middle of the woods, all the creatures are running away from you, because we're so loud and noisy. But if we go into the middle of the woods and settle down and just sit quietly, it's like this whole wave starts to come back. And that's often with investigation and meditation too. We just hold this question of where's the resistance, and we just are receptive. We just wait for the information to come to us. The little squirrel comes out, the little bird lands on our shoulder. Through our sense of being still in the middle of it and being receptive, then it comes up. So holding these questions, where is the resistance? And just letting the answer come. So investigation is not so much like thinking as listening with an intention, with a direction. And I'll just leave you with this final story. So Dan Rather, the CBS anchor, so you know he has a very investigative mind, trying to figure out what's going on. It's really thought-based. So he was interviewing Mother Teresa on TV. And it was described this way, this encounter. So somehow Dan Rather's, all his standard approaches and formula questions were inadequate for this task. And the little nun from Calcutta, sitting there beside him so sweetly and tranquilly, didn't seem inclined to make his task any easier. So finally, Dan asked, "When you pray, what do you say to God?" "I don't say anything," she replied. "I listen." So Rather tried a different tact. "Well, okay, when God speaks to you, what does he say?" "He doesn't say anything. He just listens." So Dan looked rather bewildered. For an instant, he didn't know what to say. And Mother Teresa said, "And if you don't understand that, I can't explain it to you." Okay? So this is the quality of listening to God and God listening to you. All right, let's sit quietly for a moment. Okay, so we have a few minutes for some questions, if there are comments. Yeah, Moffat.
Thanks for the encouragement to be more focused on that felt sense. I think my interest tends to lie more in closer to encore thinking. And I'm wondering if you have a way of understanding that when you're thinking and become identified with thought, it feels like, it doesn't feel like a bodily thing.
Right.
It feels like a process that I'm watching, which is feels like investigation, but you're suggesting that there's more body focus in there. I don't know how to reconcile that.
Well, I mean, the question is with investigation, that often it feels like it's a thing up in the mind. And I'm calling to more of a body sense, the felt sense. Well, I mean, the head is part of the body. So you can get a sense of, okay, the mind is kind of really caught in this or focused on this. And so as you step back enough to see what's the process that's happening, so you actually observe, what does it feel like in the head? What does it feel like in the mind and the neurons there? As you do that, you start to have a little bit more of a space around it. Space meaning that when we were involved in it, I'm thinking about it. It's like I'm in the middle of my thoughts. But if I'm able to feel the sense of the mind working, what does it actually feel like? I'm becoming more spacious. And you just relax more and more with that sense of observing the head itself. You start to connect more with the body. It's like, okay, you know, this process in the head, but I'm feeling the tension in my shoulder, I'm feeling my breath is shallow. Okay, let me connect with that a little bit. And so you just naturally, and that's what's nice about investigation, and it really any meditation, but I find it's very helpful to start where we are. We have this sense of friction of, I should be something other than I am. Then we're tying ourselves in knots. So you can even notice that. It's like, well, okay, I'm stuck in my head again. There's no felt sense. Okay, so can I connect with that sense of judging my experience? Just right where I am. It's like, because we often think we have to be, it's like we're getting a photo taken, so we have to get ourselves all prettied up before we get the photo taken. But we just, you know, with our morning hair and our clothes just disheveled, and we just want to see what's really there. Yes, George.
As you know, I have questions about investigation, but the one thing that you did observe that in the body, you know, tingling anymore from the brain, as part of this investigation, so you're holding the question about something in the relationship that's going on.
Okay.
You have a sense of your body, so isn't it really connected to thought and also connected to your identity to make any meaning out of those senses in the body? Or is this just something that's intuitive? Like, I mean, I have a pain in my side.
So the question is this about not thinking at all? Or is it a sense of the thought, using thought is an investigation trying to make some level of making meaning of it? They're using thought.
Yeah, I'm still,
Yes.
At that point, is this just, is the question of, is this a story that's skillful or in some way?
Right. Yeah, I think I understand. So just see if I can repeat the question or formulate it. So in some ways, investigation is really about befriending thought again, is learning to use it in a skillful way instead of an unconscious way or a reactive way, or as self-identified ways is the essence of it. So usually we have a sense of story that comes up around our experience, whether it's a body sensation or emotionality or thought complex, there's a whole idea that comes up with that. And there's a sense of really investing our self-identity in the midst of that. Now, if instead we start to see that we're looking at it with an idea of loosening that self-identity, then actually seeing the story and seeing the connections of the story become very helpful. So, and often a good guideline is the sense of being surprised by the connections. So, and a good way to work with it is just say, okay, I'm feeling upset about this relationship, and I'm going to tune into my body, and they seem like they're completely unrelated. I don't want to make a story of them, because they're happening at the same time. But I'm just going to tune into it. Okay, I'm upset about so-and-so doing this to me. Okay, I'm feeling this in my body. There's a tightness here. There's an ache here. And I start to, usually we're looking, but we're kind of not really looking. We're kind of cursory looking. So we start to really deepen into those experiences. At some point, suddenly something lines up. We realize, oh, this sensation really feels connected to this sense of being rejected. It's like, this is the heart of rejection. And there's a tendency to say, okay, I've done it. Okay, this is all I have to do. But if I can just keep holding that sense, okay, what does the rejection really feel like in the pit of my stomach? So I'm holding the question, I'm not going off into conclusions, but really, rejection's pit of stomach. Okay, and then, oh, and then I drop down to there's a deeper sense of fear in the belly. So just there's a kind of natural surprising factor to it. And so it becomes a kind of interesting. And then and that process starts to recalibrate our attention. Like for example, there's a sense of, as a teacher, teachers often get a lot of projection. It's like you can basically assume that people are using you as a placeholder for different people in their lives. Okay, and there's a sense of trying to work out that. There's a healing response for doing it, but it's unconscious and it's often dysfunctional in that. So if we're acting from the unconscious quality of that projection, it doesn't work so well. But if we start to connect that sense of, okay, I'm projecting on this person because of this unmet need, because of this person in my past, when I start to really see that, not intellectually, but actually feel it in the body, feel the impact on the body, there's this recalibration that I realize what happened when I was 2 or 4 or 6, doesn't have anything to do with this adult relationship. Right? There's still the pain of that, but I realize it's not about being a kid anymore. So there's this recalibration, I realize, okay, I don't have to put these on this other person. The same thing with ourselves, it's so hard to put that on ourselves. And so I would say, don't get too caught up about trying to make a story happen. The story naturally shows itself. It's like you go into the forest and say, okay, I really want to see a deer come by. And there's like an eagle comes by and a snake and a badger. I really want that deer to come by. Okay, I'm getting caught with that sense of what I want. So since I'm going to just sit here and see whatever comes up, maybe nothing, maybe something. And a lot of times you just have a sensation. There's a sensation that doesn't have any secret, deep, dark meaning. It just, you ate too much or you ate too little or, just.
As you get older, and everything starts to hurt.
Yeah. So you just connect with how the body's feeling right now. And sometimes it lines up and you make that connection. And you start to, as you do it more and more, you start to know this is probably just a body sensation and this feels like this is connected. And we'll go into this more in the next couple weeks, you know, how to work with personal story. And yeah, Michelle. Is it possible to have pure thought without any conditioning? Probably. Yeah, I think my sense is that there is some thoughts which are more of a direct seeing and a knowing of what's being seen. And there's not this movement toward it, this movement away from it. It's just like, and there's a natural way we see something, we label it, we identify it, we try to put it into some kind of, even that's going to be conditioned in a strict sense, so maybe not. Okay. But there's certainly degrees of conditionality. There can be a seeing that's, and a sense of thought that's very close to the actual experience, very light on the conditioning, where the conditioning is in the healthy way. And then usually we do more of the conditioning that's more unconscious. Yes?
Could you give us another example of an investigation that you've done and the steps that investigation took you through, like what you discovered? Just want to kind of confirm understanding.
Sure. Sure. Any particular area? Simple and concrete. Well, I'll just do it right now about that. Okay, so as I hear your question, I'm aware of the time. I know that there's announcements. And so, there's a sense of pressure, a feeling of pressure here, the sense of the body almost wants to lean forward. The breath becomes more shallow. So I'm holding the sense of time pressure. Yeah, I'm very somatically body-oriented, so I feel the body wanting to go this way for some reason. Doesn't matter why, just noticing that. There's a sense of, am I going to get in trouble for going too late? So there's that familiar tightness in the chest, around that sense of I'm ungrounded with that. There's also the sense of knowing it as I'm knowing, the sense of knowing it with enough spaciousness to say it. It happens without really catching me. It's like, okay, this is just this passing wave going through me. So you can see the connection of the question, the timing, the pressure. And I could follow that down to, the old echoes that I have to be on time to get approved of. And, there's a sense of hunching over. So you can see I'm connecting with each thought, each belief, and how I'm feeling in the body. Yeah, so it's an interesting process. And it becomes this nice gateway for action too. Like instead of acting from reactivity, I can track all these things in my body, the emotionality, the deep beliefs. I start to become less and less fooled by my reactivity. I can realize, well, okay, I won't get in that much trouble. it's not about, being liked for being on time. That doesn't, so there's a recalibration too that happens. Does that help?
That does.
Okay. All right, so we do need to stop. So thank you for your attention. And there's homework by the Donna Baskets. And Jerry has some announcements.